about joy. Pali, it would be piti or even sukha. Both words are used to describe this quality, which is felt to be deeply important in this path. Now, I think we would probably all like to think that there is a shortcut to joy. If we look at the reality or the actuality of joy in our lives when we encounter it, we see how much the qualities of energy and interest and investigation and mindfulness are all woven into the fabric of joy. It is, however, deeply important that joy is both looking backwards to these qualities, but that it is also informing the kind of effort that we make, not only in our practice, but in our lives. Is it joyful effort that we bring to practicing and to living our lives, or do we have more of an attitude of grimness? And that this is, you know, even our practice is something we tick off our to-do list before we get on to the next task. Now, joy I find a very sort of, you know, because I would like to not think of joy so much as one state versus another state. Huh? I think that would be a kind of a detour and unhelpful. And when the Buddha is talking about these qualities, he is talking about qualities and not states. So is there the possibility of there being an attitude of joy even when the content of your experience may be unpleasant or difficult? Cohen. Does joy rely on pleasant contents? Now, if we do have the association in ourselves that joy implies the absence of the difficult or the unpleasant or the challenging, I guess it's pretty apparent that our encounters with joy are going to be fairly short-lived and intermittent. So this is where I think it is so important to translate joy or to shift joy out of this state or experience or association into an attitude, context. I mean, do you believe that joy is dependent upon pleasant sensations and experiences? And
yes.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's interesting what the implication of that in our lives, of how joy is, you know, and maybe also we need to redefine joy, that's part of it. But the implications of having that association is that our lives, our minds, our hearts are probably going to kind of ricochet between joy and depression or joy and unhappiness or joy and distress as all passing states of mind. And I really think that what the Buddha is referring to here is something much deeper and more reliable than a state of mind that is conditioned by contents. So that's actually a big leap and a big question for us to hold. Can a sense of joy be related to a sense of something being worthy or valuable, even if the contents are difficult? I mean, if you take just your practice as a sort of example, nobody always has happy states in meditation. If our lives are bringing difficulties, loss, change, why should we imagine that we would have a happy state? And of course it would be much more human for us to feel the sadness of being with that, to feel the grief, to feel the loss of being with that. Can we sense the joy of the worthiness of doing that? The value of doing that? If we look at our lives, I doubt if anybody has sort of relationships that are reliably happy. Uncontentious. I doubt if any of us have work situations that is an uninterrupted sequence of pleasant moments. I don't. So what is it that's going to allow us to move from this place of our consciousness being hostage to the world of conditions, which inevitably will hold the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral? And I think this is a deeper investigation about what our kind of perhaps most profound or deepest aspirations and values and commitments are. And perhaps there's joy in being awake to what is, independent of the feeling tone of what is. I mean, there is something, and I do think that this is a really important question for us, you know, because if we could imagine that our life and our path is in the pursuit of that uninterrupted sequence of pleasant sensations, we are going to be subject to doubt. We are going to be subject to senses of hopelessness, impossibility. Isn't it a completely different way of reframing our path to think that our path, the heart of our path, is a dedication to being awake and alive in the midst of all changing conditions? I think this is the quality of liberation the Buddha is pointing towards, not a state of happiness. There's a saying in the Tibetan tradition where it says, do not think these small moments of heedlessness do not matter. It only takes a tiny spark to set a mountain afire. It goes on to say, do not think that these small moments of mindfulness and kindness do not matter, because all of the great oceans are filled drop by drop. It kind of reframes the intentionality, it reframes the aspiration, it reframes that which brings joy is actually filling the ocean and not setting the mountain afire. Now, I think often in this teaching, people hear piti or joy as being particularly associated with meditative states of deep concentration or jhanas, you know, where often that's where you hear the word piti or joy kind of most highlighted. But in the qualities of awakening and in the factors of awakening, the Buddha is actually not referring to transient states, but to qualities that are cultivated in all moments and in all circumstances. But joy is one of those very kind of pivotal, central, seminal qualities. Even in the discourses, when the Buddha talks about the cultivation and the deepening and the development of insight, he talks about dry insight, which is insight without the inwardly generated joy born of concentration. And the opposite of dry insight is not wet insight. but it's more the insight that is the insight and the development of insight that is instead permeated, pervaded with this quality of inwardly generated joy. Now, I think it's really, you know, because so often we think of joy going to be a consequence or as an effect of deep meditation. But I think it's really important to notice in the factors of awakening that joy is a quality that precedes concentration. It's a quality that precedes the development of deep collected states. In some of the suttas, the Buddha says, in a mind of happiness, concentration or wise attention finds a true foundation. It's interesting, so often we think that we're trying to concentrate in order to be happy. You know, and in this, the Buddha is saying, find the way to be happy, then concentrate. It's a completely different order. And, you know, why is that so? I mean, I think in your own experience, we probably all would acknowledge how the mind finds it difficult to develop a sustained attention when it's constantly being distracted or entangled in conflicts and arguments and unfinished business. When the mind is not happy, it doesn't come to collectedness. When the mind is caught, say like in the pursuit of craving or aversion, it doesn't come to stillness, does it? It just generates endless agitation. So one of the first instructions I was given in meditation was to free myself of indebtedness. And that's a phrase that is repeatedly used in the discourses. Free yourself from indebtedness. If it doesn't just mean financial indebtedness. But if you have, I don't know if you've ever experienced a time when you have been financially indebted and you know what it does to the mind or what it can do to the mind, the tremendous sense of burden, of anxiety, the endless thinking about it, you know, how am I going to deal with this? It's a tremendous sense of disquiet, of carrying around this load. And then perhaps, you know, in that metaphor, also the capacity to repay that debt, it's like lifting the burden. The cloud is gone. The sense of heaviness is gone. You know, the Buddha compares it to kind of being freed from slavery. But I think the kind of indebtedness that the Buddha is referring to here is not just financial indebtedness, but psychological and emotional indebtedness. And I feel that if we want to know what we're indebted to, we only need to look at what our attention is constantly entangled with. The repetitive stories where we keep going, where the sense of unfinished business, of not being at peace, and it actually creates exactly the same sort of feeling as if we were financially indebtedness, like we can never really be free of this or very far away from it, you know, that it returns again and again. And again, when the Buddha talks about being free of indebtedness, again, it's not just a one-dimensional approach, you know. Pay back your debt. How do you do that emotionally, psychologically? I mean, I think sometimes being free of indebtedness does involve, at times, outer acts of peacemaking. It's not just internal. But I think being free of indebtedness sometimes really means asking of ourselves a question of how do I make peace with that which is unfinished? It's not as if it's so simple that we can just finish everything, is it? Finishing things often involves, you know, more than us. Might involve other people, you know, other situations that have long gone by. But what is it that is really needed for us to make peace with that which is unfinished? But it is important because I'm sure many of us have had the experience of sitting in meditation and feeling, you know, entire retreats dedicated to sort of recycling a loop that we have recycled 10,000 times before. It doesn't seem to go anywhere. you know, and struggling to, you know, get rid of it, you know, and concentrate or something. But what do we need to do to free ourselves of indebtedness? Sometimes it's a recognition we can do no more. You know, sometimes there is investigation, there is insight here in terms of kindness, in terms of being able to put something down, in terms of restraint and not feeding the unfinished. It's so multidimensional, you know, that involves actually everything that we've been talking about so far. Now, I think we could say that joy is not so much an experience, but that joy is a passionate interest. It's a passionate interest. You've had this sense externally, I'm sure all of us, when we've been passionately interested in something, the sense of joy, which is different than excitement or a high. But the passionate interest in the nature of the mind when it's freed from craving, aversion, and clinging. The passionate interest in what that heart, what that mind actually looks like. The passionate interest in the nature of the mind that's not in dispute with anything, anywhere. And I think here, you know, there is a kind of way that preceding this, there is a need to stop and to be still and to really, you know, to step out of the busyness. I don't know if it's been translated properly for me, but I've been told that the calligraphy, the Chinese calligraphy for busyness translates as heart-killing. You know, and sometimes that's what we need to step out of to begin to actually really question where is the source of joy, because that is the essence of this teaching, that the source of joy and the source of despair lives in our own hearts and not in the conditions of the world, as difficult as they may be. Now, there are different kinds of joy that are spoken of, both sensual and non-sensual. Now, it is, of course, very easy to get the impression that the Buddha is rather down on sensual joy. You know, when you go into monasteries and skeletons line the walls of the meditation hall, you know, and or you go to retreats and there seems to be a sort of implicit agreement that we sort of look grim in order to be virtuous, you know. But the Buddha, she was not down on sensual joy at all, or on worldly joy. The acknowledgement of how many there are of lovely sights and sounds and tastes and touch and sensations, to know the loveliness of many thoughts, not as something to be avoided, but as something to be appreciated. It is not a more noble practice to be grappling with suffering in every moment. You know, and I won't go there. That's a big rant of mine. You know, that fear that this appreciation will turn into clinging. Actually, the truth is that the loveliness, sensual loveliness, I think, gladdens the mind. I think it gladdens the mind. It gladdens the mind. It can have such a taste of spaciousness, of gladness, of appreciation, which is a little touch of joy, you know? And sometimes, you know, that's how we begin to learn about joy, is about learning what a gladdened heart actually feels like. But it's also being aware that it's not just the loveliness of impressions that gladdens the heart and brightens the mind. It is the qualities of mindfulness and appreciation that are brought to those lovely impressions. Because if the mindfulness is not there, if the appreciation is not there, quite frankly, we could move to the most lovely of sensory impressions and not have the heart gladdened at all. So it's really so important to appreciate that quality of mindfulness that allows the gladdening of the heart. You know, the qualities of connectedness and seeing wholeheartedly that allows the heart to be gladdened. Now, clearly this quality of joy has, again, a lot of different nuances, because there is sensual joy of pleasure, there is appreciative joy, you know, being able to celebrate the happiness and the delights of others and of ourselves. There is also the quality of non-sensual joy born of insight and relinquishment, the relinquishment of the difficult. There is joy found in very deep states of absorption or concentration, which I will speak about later. There is also joy within very deep developments of mindfulness. That sense that there is nothing lacking in this moment, the sense of sufficiency. Now, I think, you know, in reframing joy not to be a state, there is some kind of very, I think, very important and very profound insight involved in that reframing. Because when we think of joy or happiness as a state that is related only to pleasant sensations, there's a huge load of projection, projected promise or enchantment that is going on in that. You know, that has the power to make me happy. You know, or that holds the implicit power to gladden my mind. You hold the implicit power to gladden my heart, and you certainly don't. You know, there is this sort of projected power, isn't there, that the source of joy or the source of happiness actually lies in the things and the events and the experiences of the world, which is why we begin to believe we can only be joyful when we are in connection with that which is pleasant. We can feel the disappointment that then is going to be woven into our lives. So in a way, reclaiming the source of joy as being in our own hearts, reclaiming a sort of inwardly generated joy. Quite frankly, on one level, this is totally ethical because it liberates the world from having the onerous duty of making us happy all the time. And to liberate other people from the onerous duty and responsibility to make us happy all the time. So in a way, reclaiming, you know, withdrawing that projected promise, acknowledging that the source of joy is in our own heart, on one level, it really does liberate the world, but it's also waking up from a dream of enchantment. This dream of belief, when there is this projected power into things and situations and people to make us happy, you know, what is the consequence of that? Running around the world craving, you know, running around the world with insistence, never having enough, never, you know, receiving enough, you know, and then of course the downside of that aversion. So there is some very powerful insight piece here, which is about breaking this enchantment spell and actually really kind of withdrawing that projected promise and acknowledging that, you know, joy is generated within, not from. Doesn't mean that there's not lovely things, but as I mentioned, the loveliest things in the world are actually not going to gladden the mind unless we are able to receive them. One of the great benefits of deep concentration practice, I think, and actually deep insight practice too, is that there is the encounter with and the discovery of an inwardly born happiness in which there is a sure conviction that there is nothing that's going to be born as a result of craving or pursuit that can actually ever compare with that inwardly born happiness and joy. That is such a big thing in the development of meditative practices, you know, because it does completely alter our relationship to the world. It's what enables ethics, but it completely alters our relationship to life when there's this freedom from this insistence on the world having to be the provider of our happiness. It so much reduces the clinging element. It so much softens and mutes the craving element. And in a way, you can also get a sense, it's such a profound step into a greater sense of freedom. You know, because if I am insisting that the world is providing me with happiness, I am really a hostage to conditions. I am really in bondage to the world of changing conditions. And changing conditions mean I'm going to be in bondage to this endlessly changing mental states, you know, of happiness and disappointment. So I think it is so important to acknowledge, you know, that also that joy is not just something that is magical. Like everything else in these qualities of awakening, joy is a cultivation. It's really a cultivation. And I know sometimes it can feel like really far away, joy. But sometimes we just also need to remind ourselves of the possibility of joy. You know, wise use of the sense doors is very helpful in that. You know, instead of that kind of plowing through the world, you know, in this contracted state, to be able to stop and to breathe out and to see wholeheartedly, to listen wholeheartedly, to be touched. Again, it's just a little reminder of joy. You know, to treasure our capacities for stillness, to treasure our capacities for empathy or compassion, a little taste of joy. But again, what we cultivate, we bring into being. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. The Buddha, you know, really did present this path as a path of happiness that leads to the highest happiness. You know, not as a path of misery that leads to the deepest misery, you know. And it actually speaks about everything in the path as being a cultivation of joy. You know, speaking about the joy of letting go. You're speaking about the joy of calmness, the joy of stillness. Speaking about the joy of ethics, of a life of integrity. The Buddha speaks about the bliss of blamelessness, which again is really referring to this heart and mind which is not burdened by residues. The joy in engaging with what is wholesome and beneficial, the joy of awakening. It's a passionate interest. It's a quiet and more reliable joy rather than, you know, the highs and the intensities and the buzz. It's a more quiet and reliable joy that needs, I think, is cultivated in our lives, and I think it is cultivated in our meditation practice. I don't think you should sit down on a cushion until you can smile at it. And that doesn't mean that everything that happens on that cushion is going to be fantastic and lovely and pleasant, but to know that every moment spent there is a moment of worthiness, that it is dedicated to awakening, it's dedicated to compassion, it's dedicated to kindness. It's a passionate interest. And I have to say that much greater joy is available to us when we're not taking everything so darn personally. You know, I am like this, and this is happening to me, and this is my mental state, you know, mine is, and you know, that long, long story of of me and mine and what belongs to me. Because that's when I think when we can welcome the stream of events of our life without being overwhelmed. It's joy. Anybody have any reflections or thoughts about joy?
first time I ever said to myself, inwardly, may your happiness and joy continue and increase. That was the big turning point in how my life. I still knew where I was, but still, it was very touching.
And it was being able to really attend to it.
Yeah. Surprised joy.
I have found that I've got this little technique that has brought a lot more joy into my practice, and that is when I sit down, I will ask where in my body feels good.
Yeah.
And I go there and I focus my attention there.
No, I think it's useful, and you can even expand that, you know, because I think very often we can sit down with a certain agenda and a certain project. And I think every sitting, it's very important to sort of have an orientation in attitude. That it is actually a clear sense of intentionality. And, you know, it can be where in my body feels good, or where do I sense calmness? You know, is my earlobe calm? You know, is the palm of my hand calm? Because I think it's often remembering what we're cultivating, you know, rather than feeling that we turn up on a cushion, you know, anything happens, it's just, you know, what happens. There is a sense of intentionality about what are we cultivating, you know, attitudinally, not as again as a state. Because, you know, if you can have a sense of what feels well, or what feels calm, that is the kind of attitude then that is brought to receive everything that arises, including what is not well. But it's removing that sense of contractedness. You know, I mean, I find sometimes when I work with people with sort of chronic pain or chronic anxiety or, you know, those very distressed states, you know, my encouragement will actually be, yes, to be able to contrast that with actually even one tiny little piece, whether it's your fingertip, that is not stressed, that is not agitated, that is not anxious, to know the feeling of that and the attitude of that, the sense of that, to be brought back to that which is agitated and distressed. But it is kind of establishing a certain orientation. You know, and I think what we do in the practice is also a training for our lives, and we need to always keep acknowledging that parallel. Establishing an orientation which is not already, chronically sort of lost in contractedness. It's an interesting one. You know, a couple of years ago when I was very ill, you know, and my doctor was trying to convince me I was very ill. And I kept saying, you know, but I'm really not very ill. You know, my shoulder doesn't hurt. You know, the back of my neck feels really well. You know, my hand is doing fantastic. And he kept saying, you're really ill, you're really ill. You know, you mean I'm really ill. You know, no, that piece is not working so well. You know, but there's a whole lot that it, and he would sit there and look at me with a sort of sense of bemusement, you know, like this woman is really nuts, you know, like why can't she just accept this diagnosis that she's really, I mean, the shadow side of that is you don't take it too seriously, but, or as seriously as you need to, but there is that sense, you know, of how often we define the whole of the moment by the particular. And the particular never is the whole of the moment. The particular is part of the landscape of the moment. But to know the whole of the moment is actually very important for us being able to address the particular with spaciousness and ease. Anyone have anything on joy?
I found your talk on Friday about contentedness.
Contentment, yeah.
I just thought about joy the whole time.
in it, but the sense of inner joy already being there. And every time that I related your words to what was going on within me, I just located like a physical feeling of joy that was very calm.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to revisit that place, that, you know, what we are talking about cultivating here are seeds that are already present in our minds and hearts. And not talking about importing something, but that capacity to know that those seeds are there and that sometimes they just need attention. Which is not a denial of the difficult, but allows for the difficult a completely different way.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to say that the comment you made about finding joy in observing, maybe, is something that really resonates with me, because that's happened a number of times where, for instance, I'll be lost in wandering mind, sloth and torpor and everything, and then suddenly I see that I'm lost in wandering mind, and then a sense of joy arises that I have seen that, and that's really a striking thing.
Yes. I mean, the quality of mindfulness itself is not troubled. You know, the quality of knowing is not troubled. It is the contents that can be troubled, but the knowing is already a kind of relinquishment of being entangled in the troubled. And there is a joy in relinquishment. I mean, I think there's always a joy in laying down a burden. You know, that's not bad news. You know, whenever we kind of, you know, even the little burdens that can be laid down, there is a sense of lightening in relinquishment. And so the Buddha talks really about the happiness of letting go. You know, the happiness of relinquishment.
I knew when I raised my hand I'd regret having done it, because I because I feel, just as a summary, I don't get it, okay? I hear everything you're saying and I can identify with many things, but I have a mini joy. You know, my idea of joy is something, you know,
euphoric.
Ode to joy, yes.
Yeah.
I do have experienced all that you've said, but I've never considered it as joy, because it's not enough to me to label it joy. And I think euphoric is, you hit it right on the head, is what I think of as joy. So you talked about redefining joy. How would you define joy? I mean, you can't get into my head, but then maybe you can understand what I'm saying, that it's an absence of the negative rather than a presence of a super positive.
No, because I think what we're referring to there is the euphoria. You know, in the euphoria is a mental state.
Okay.
And it's a mental state. And it's not to say that that mental state is not valid, but it's one of the spectrum of our mental states.
Okay.
And, you know, that mental state usually is triggered by conditions. Okay. What I really want to stress is that if that is our only framework for joy, then we are lost in the framework that joy is reliant upon conditions being happy conditions. The big danger in that is that no one can sustain conditions the same. So that euphoric mental state could be replaced or followed by an equally downcast mental state as other conditions arise. So I think the reframing is certainly acknowledging that, you know, the spectrum of mental states that we experience in our life, But that enchantment piece underneath that is the piece that's leading us to an absence of joy in our lives. Because we will be always kind of chasing the conditions and then blaming the conditions and arguing with the conditions. So the kind of joy we're talking about here, I mean, there is euphoric joy. There's no doubt about that. You know? But I think the kind of joy that we're really pointing here as an awakening factor is, again, not one born of conditions, but born within. And in this, it is more subtle. You know, euphoric joy comes in headlines, you know, bells and smells, you know. There's no disguising it. There's no mistaking it. It's very uplifting. Within that euphoric joy, there is a taste of this calmer, quieter joy, which is not reliant on conditions. It's not that it's a different joy, but it is a mental state. But there's a taste in that of this calmer, quieter joy that can stand in the midst of all conditions in a place of ease, contentment, sufficiency. Nothing lacking. And then it does have these different nuances too, the nuances of celebration, you know, the nuances of appreciation, the nuances of brightness, but also the nuances of insight, which is knowing, really resting the heart that is not bound to conditions.
Yeah.
You're not in trouble raising your hand. You won't regret raising your
hand. I found that merely directing my attention to looking for joy and contentment, which are the words I typically use, that I can feel it rushing up and washing through my body every time.
You're fortunate.
I mean, I don't always remember to look.
Ah.
But when I, you know, when I'm meditating, you know, and I'm, you know, it's in a meditative state, it seems to always be there in a well that comes up.
I mean, certainly there are meditative states, and we will go on to this in concentration, meditative states which really are featured by much more the sort of euphoric, surging PT. But again, you know, the meditative state is a taste too, of what is possible. And I just think there is something valuable about putting the possibility of joy, not euphoric joy, but the joy of wakefulness into the forefront of our consciousness in all conditions.
One way that I have experienced joy is in nature, like on mountains especially. And sometimes, even when I'm meditating, I'll try to put my mind there to kind of, you know, bring back that experience, and I find that helpful. I'm getting it there, but is that, you know, okay to just kind of, it's almost like visualizing that place where I have, it's going back to a place or an experience where I have found joy, but then if I bring it back, I can feel that and then bring it to the new experience of meditating.
I mean, I think there's all these different nuances in there, because, you know, because there can be something quite skillful just in the memory of collectedness, the memory of calmness, the memory of spaciousness. You know, and then to translate that into an intentionality and a cultivation, I think, can be very helpful. In fact, concentration practices will use the development of cellular memories of joy or happiness as a way of kind of calling them forth and evoking them. The place to be careful of course, is that we don't think that our meditation should only have one flavor, you know, and that the kind of intentionality to sort of posit the possibility of joy or remember the possibility of joy is not being used as a means to actually kind of push away the difficult or the unpleasant mental states that are there. But again, I think it is a little bit of, you mentioned earlier, it's a question of orientation in practice, you know. And, you know, I mean, I do think there is something about every time we turn up to practice that it's really important to remember what we're doing there. And actually, that there is a sense of intentionality which is different than having a project. But that there is a kind of attitudinal sense which is actually deeply, deeply important in the development of meditative practice. And actually these qualities of awakening are really speaking true, you know, especially the, you know, energy, joy, wise effort are really, really speaking to a sort of attitudinal approach to practice, you know, where it's not just all an accident or whatever I bump into on the cushion, that there is a sense of what is being cultivated, you know, what this is in the service of.
Yes, in kind of re what you're saying and understanding, what's coming forth for me is confidence and freedom from conditions. And that is so different for me than the experience I have in mountains or in other places. So that's what I'm hearing and that's what I'm feeling.
It is really speaking, I mean, certainly all of this is speaking about the confidence and freedom, not from conditions, but within conditions, okay? The freedom within all conditions, rather than... And, you know, but actually we need to keep reading our lives to find the clues to that, you know? We need to read in our lives to find the clue to joy, you know, the clue to wise effort, or the clue to energy. So it's not, you know, it's not as if I'm saying, oh yes, I'm on a mountaintop, I'm joyful, you know, that's certain conditions. No, but that's what a joyful heart feels like. Let me remember that. That's what a joyful heart feels like. And what does that feel like in the midst of difficult mental states or difficult conditions? You know, because I think, you know, our learning is a lot of times informed by life experiences that we don't always pay attention to. You know, or don't read the implications of. That's a better way of saying. For example, intellectually, you know, all of us would agree with impermanence. You know, but we don't actually look, what are the implications of that? You know, we've all had experiences of suffering. You know, we can have experiences of suffering without any insight into it at all. You know, we've had experiences of connectedness, but we can have experiences of connectedness and love without actually the insight into that. So I think the whole orientation of the practice is to read, in a way, to read the experiences of our lives and look at what is the insight into those experiences. You know, people can have fantastic meditation experiences without any insight into them. That's just to say. Then nothing changes. So our life is changed not by experience alone, but by the insight into experience.
I live in housing for older people, and I don't really find many people that I can share those insights with at all. It's just not important. It's more important what you do in your life. But it's really nice. I mean, I just like I'll see someone on the bus or someone holding their child, and they'll be like, oh, that is so beautiful. Or come out and the lawn has been mown. It's like, but they're all
also very sensory. They're based on what I see, what I smell, sometimes what I hear. And I'm not thinking of another time. I'm just thinking, oh, I love that smell of the mown lawn. Or there's a certain fall smell that has to do with the leaves turning and being damp. And the awareness of it makes me happy.
Yes. Because without the mindfulness of it, it doesn't evoke happiness. I mean, pleasant sensations do not implicitly evoke happiness without the mindfulness of them. But the difficulty is then we put the happiness making in the sensation rather than in the awareness of them.
Fine line there.
It's a very fine line there. Has big implications, that line.
I was thinking about experiences that I have where there's both pleasant and unpleasant sensual inputs, and choosing to pay attention to the one that is pleasant. And I'm thinking of my goddaughter learning the trombone. And the sounds that were coming out were horrific. And the cheeks blowing out were so beautiful. And the sound disappeared as I looked at the cheeks. I felt like I was choosing joy.
Well, we do choose what we do with our attention, consciously or unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And what we choose to do with our attention will certainly shape the state of our mind. But that's again, you know, there's this very fine line then, do I not attend to anything unpleasant, you know, because, you know, I don't like it and it makes, you know, seems to make me unhappy.
Mm-hmm. I know, they're kind of a slippery slope.
It's just kind of, yeah. But at the same time, we are always choosing, consciously or unconsciously, what we are paying attention to. And what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. But there's that side piece there, you know, that's so important to be aware of, because we cannot just always choose the pleasant. And if we are incapacitated by believing that we only can be happy in the pleasant, then we will be helpless in the unpleasant.
I'm struggling with the conception that we heard yesterday about the sense of non-self. And I'm wondering if I'm falling into a trap here or something, but there's something about this notion of sort of bringing a discernment to any moment where you can say, even in a distressing moment, but there is joy here. I'm wondering, is that going down the road toward an understanding of I am not the distress. I am not the joy. I'm something bigger than that. Is that what you meant by or is it part of what you meant by the non-self?
Part of it is, yes, not being identified with experience. Not being identified with the contents of experience. I think the piece that's actually very important to acknowledge here is that before liberation you will have a self, and after liberation you will have a self. Before liberation you may have a clinging, identified, wrong view self. After liberation you will still have a self, you know. And I think this is where we often get stuck, you know, because we do have a very felt sense of self, you know. When I get up in the morning, you know, I know who I am. You know, it's not a surprise every time I look in the mirror, you know. Oh, look who's there, you know. It's like I know who I am. You know, I know what I need to be doing that day, you know. I have a whole history, you know, and a family, you know, that I don't have amnesia about, you know. I mean, so that's, I think, often the place that causes confusion for us, because it's such a felt sense of having a self. That is not a problem. Never has been a problem. What is much more a problem is, first of all, there's two dimensions of atta, or self, that are spoken about in the teaching. Now, one dimension of self that gets us into trouble is in the formation of personality view. Okay, so how do I form personality view? Because there is identification with the body, therefore I am the body. There's identification with feeling, therefore I am this, that, or the other. There's the identification with perception, so therefore I am the history. There's the identification with consciousness. I am my thoughts, I am my memories, I am my emotions, I am my states. This is a formation of personality view, which you can sense changes constantly through the day, right, depending upon what is being identified with. So selfing, in the sense of personality view, is really just another word for clinging or identification. It's the formation of a fixed view in that moment of I am. This is who I am. This is, you know, this belongs to me. This is me. So you can see the personality view is something that has been changing through our entire lives, and it changes moment to moment depending on what it's being identified with. So what is being taken away there? The body's not being taken away through insight. Feeling is not being taken away through insight. Perception's not being taken away. Emotion's not being taken away. What's being taken away is the contracting and the identify and the freezing, and then the formation of personality view. This is who I am, who I was, who I always be. And we can see how much trouble we get into through that. Now, taking away the clinging, everything else, you know, still going on. I still know who I am. I still know who that is in the mirror. You know, I know what I need to do today. But it's very different when there's not the clinging for me. So that's one dimension of selfing, okay? Self that is really kind of examined, you know, and it's a very kind of digestible understanding, I think, you know, this sort of formation of personality. The other form of self that is spoken about in the teaching is more subtle. It's more subtle, a little bit more tricky. It's called mano, which is the conceit of self. Okay? So here we've got this one very visible level of personality view being self. And this other one underneath it is mano, or the conceit of self. Okay, so we can quite logically and, you know, impeccably observe personality view being formed. And by the way, personality view is then, of course, forming our view of the world, right? You know, if I'm a failure, you know, if I'm anxious, the whole world is, of course, a threat. You know? Yeah. If I'm angry, the whole world is annoying. You know, if I'm hopeless, the whole world is filled with, you know, unreachable possibilities. So bearing in mind that personality is also, view is also forming view of all other selves and worlds. Now this one of mano is again, as I say, it's more hidden, but I think as we start to sort of like have a little bit more spaciousness and non-identification with personality view, this thought comes up in this interminable question that comes up on retreats. Who is watching? You know, who is the observer? This sense that behind all this kind of changing personality view, there is still this kind of independent observer, the pilot in the cockpit, the director of operations. You know, it's not so changing. It's kind of sitting back there somewhere, and that, in the subtlest sense, is me. Bear in mind, in terms of the relinquishing of confusion and delusion, the confusion or the delusion of mano, or personality view, in the kind of structure of awakening is one of the last confusions and delusions to fall away. So be patient with that one. To to acknowledge the possibility or even the question, you know, that this conceit of self may be as sort of, may have no more independent self-existence and personality view does. Just hold that as an open possibility, that even, that the conceit of self has no more independent self-existence and personality view does. Huh? Because we can see that personality view doesn't have an independent self-existence, it's changing, determined by conditions. So just to hold the possibility that mano, or this conceit of self, may actually fall in exactly the same universal principles of not having independent self-existence. But it is much more subtle, but it's not something to fret with. I just don't feel, you know, the conceit of self is something you cannot make it into a project, you cannot make it into an undertaking to dismantle. You know, you can acknowledge the reality that there is this sense back there of the pilot in the cockpit that may or may not be true, but to not fret with it, because I think it's far more important, you know, the cultivation, I say, of some of the awakening qualities, the cultivation of insight is what is going to see through that personality view. So any endeavor for me to let go of the conceit of self is going to be a futile endeavor. Eh? I only need to, because that actually is conceit of self. That I'm going to let go of it. That I'm in charge of letting go. That's mano. It's still imagining this kind of centralization of operations in me. So being aware that any endeavor to go down that route of I am now going to let go of the conceit of self doesn't make a lot of sense. But what really far wiser use of energy to cultivate the climate, the conditions, the understanding that allows the seeing that actually maybe there is no centralization at all, which does not stop me getting up in the morning and know who's looking back at me in the mirror and going about my day and undertaking what is skillful and helpful and, you know, not undertaking what is not makes no difference to that. I know whose shoes are outside the door. But it's functional. You know, a couple of years ago here when somebody took my shoes, I could live with that too, you know, and wear somebody else's shoes for a couple of years, you know. It was all right. So is that kind of point to that a little bit?
It almost brings to mind sort of some kind of notion of there is wise selfing and there is unwise selfing.
I think just functional selfing, practical selfing. And wise. I mean, if you even think about the development of meditation practices, you know, in a way meditation techniques are co-opting the relative self, aren't we? I'm cultivating attention, you know, I'm cultivating kindness, I'm cultivating ethics. It's co-opting, you know. It never was a problem, you know. So I think it's really important to sort of reframe what is really the issue here, what really causes suffering. It's never been the sort of relative me that gets... It's always been clinging and wrong view and delusion. So may we struggle less with the idea of this non-self. And again, I just think it becomes one of those charged phrases, you know, that really needs to be unpacked. Huh?